The value of being good is not as great as I had thought. There has to be something else involved which makes being good valuable for other people. Perhaps it is to be without internal conflict, to be clear about oneself, but also to be able to endure. You, Mr. Eichhorn, were so committed to your altruism that you underestimated your hostilities, I used to think. Here was the puzzle. How could a man who spent 16 hours a day with the most troubled youth achieve such an enviable degree of harmony? Now, what I had always wanted for myself from the beginning was nothing more than the affection of the people with whom I was in contact, and their good opinion of me.
Good opinion? Affection? Do not forget, Miss Freud, how rumors flew in the psychoanalytic society about who was courting you, the devoted, beloved, young as the daughter.
Was I ever in love with Siegfried Bernfeld?
Well, Bernfeld, tall, gaunt, flamboyant, unfortunately already married, was certainly a more likely candidate than some of the others proposed. Zionist, socialist, organizer of the May 1918 Zionist Youth Rally.
The very first mass youth rally I ever witnessed. And then all those other events in Vienna after the First War to promote resettlement in Palestine. But what interested me in Bernfeld, Mr. Eichhorn, was his youth work. I met Bernfeld when he founded the Baumgarten Children's Home for Jewish War Orphans. Papa had laid down the gauntlet at the 1918 Congress in Budapest. Psychoanalysis must reach out to the widest social strata. I had helped in a day centre for working-class children while a teacher in training, and I had done some voluntary work for the American Joint Distribution Committee towards the end of the war. The Joint sponsored Bernfeld's Baumgarten House project and were committed to the education of all the abandoned and destitute children in preparation for their emigration to Palestine.
Montessori methods, trade apprenticeships, communal self-sufficiency, the working through in practical terms of the early psychoanalytic work on childhood and adolescence. A most impressive program.
But the setting was dreary. A poorly equipped, ramshackled former military hospital barracks. On October 13th, 1919, Baumgarten opened. 240 children, 40 under 5, some disabled, all starving.
Undisciplined, traumatized.
I never actually worked at the home, but I attended all Bernfeld lectures. Later, he became disillusioned after the Joint withdrew funding over disagreements about his progressive methods. But he helped us set up the analytic training program in Vienna before moving to Berlin.
Oh, like so many others, he could not resist the magnet of Berlin. Oh, you know the story he tells. He claims he went to your papa and said, "Dear esteemed Professor Freud, I want to be an analyst. And I have heard that in Berlin, psychoanalytic beginners have a training analysis before starting to practice. Could you perhaps give me such a preparation?" "Nonsense," said your papa. "Just go right ahead. You'll certainly have difficulties, and when you get into trouble, just come to me and we'll see what we can do about it." Your papa then sent him a rich American tourist who wanted to be analyzed during a one-month stay in Vienna. Bernfeld went back to your papa in alarm. "Well," said your papa, "you know more than he does, so just show him what you know." But Bernfeld failed, or so he claims. Even after he himself began training others formally in Vienna, that he still needed a proper didactic analysis himself. So off he went to Berlin.
Really, all these young men were dreaming about was being analysed by my papa. They were shattered when Papa ever so gently had to decline. And now Bernfeld's in the States, yet again married, publishing his biographical jottings about Papa, aided and abetted by the wife.
This upsets you.
These publications are intrusive and likely to be misunderstood and sensationalised by the uninitiated, as always.
Ah, the shibboleth of sexuality.
Well, I am now beginning to reconcile myself reluctantly to the need for an accurate, authorised biographical study. Though Papa said biographical truth does not exist, and if it did, we could not use it. But back in the early 20s, Bernfeld and I had our informal study circle at my home to discuss education and child psychology. Papa smoking his pipe in the next room, where we were joined by you, Mr. Eichhorn. 17 years older than me, somewhat wider girth, especially for those lean post-war years, always dressed in black, cigarette poised in elegant holder, like a flaneur or a criminal mastermind. Social advisor to the city of Vienna, my education about Vienna's social services came entirely from you, Mr. Eichhorn, traipsing around breathlessly behind you on your whirlwind visits to your 17 guidance clinics, and director of a renowned residential institution for delinquent boys.
In the original intake of the home for delinquent boys that I founded in the devastation of an abandoned refugee camp as the old imperial world fell apart, I was confronted with 12 adolescents who were considered completely beyond the pale. Even the majority of my idealistic co-workers felt these lads could be brought to heel only by the strictest discipline and the hardest physical labour. That this merely reintroduces the child to his original conflict. So I decided to take charge of the boys myself with the help of 2 female co-workers, and I proceeded to allow their aggression full rein.
Full rein?
Well, aggression can only rise to a certain pitch. Since I did not oppose the destructive behaviour, the aggression was bound to reach a climax. At first, this attitude invited even more acts of aggression, increasing in intensity. When they did not get corporal punishment for their provocations, these boys, conditioned by their pasts, interpreted as weakness in the workers. So they became even more aggressive, deriving revenge for their own deprivations by inflicting pain on others. They practically demolished the premises. The other workers not involved in this experiment repeatedly sent for the police, as the boys' behaviour retreated further and further into feral destructiveness.
You had to either carry on or admit defeat.
The first change in the boys was observed when a performance of rage took the place of genuine rage. One boy assailed another with a knife, threatening to slit his throat. Recognising this as an act, I quietly stood by. The boy threw the knife on the ground, and howling with frustration, finally fell into an exhausted sleep. Similar scenes occurred with each of the 12 boys. A period of instability followed. They behaved so well.
You thought they were cured.
Then, without warning, like lava out of a volcano, the outbreaks would begin again. But over time, the outbursts became less frequent, and an emotional bond began to develop between the boys and us. I thought this was a propitious moment to heighten some strong, pleasurable emotion, and Christmas offered the opportunity. These boys were given their own Christmas tree and special presents. What a joy it was to observe what they experienced. Because of the identification of each boy with the unconditionally accepting me, and the developing emotional bonds between the members of the group themselves, groundwork had been laid for a positive response to the attitudes and expectations of youth workers and therapists.
In 1925, you finished your book, Wayward Youth. Through all our long, enriching evening meetings at my home, as it unfolded, you had shared its progression with us. Papa wrote the preface. Children have become the main subject of psychoanalytic research and have thus replaced in importance the neurotic on whom its studies began.
You had dearly wanted me to become a friend of the family, but I was so in awe of your papa, and so self-conscious about my lack of psychoanalytic training, that I would only go to the psychoanalytic society meetings as a silent observer. The wit scared me.
The Jewish wit. You took your place at the bottom of the table.
Well, I had been born into a conservative Catholic family, prosperous but with peasant antecedents. My father, a bank director in Vienna, lost all his money in the crash of 1873, and I had to work in my maternal grandmother's bakery. My familiarity with the bakery boys introduced me to the world and argot of Viennese petty adolescent criminality and its temptations. poor for me to pursue an academic career, and at 20, the year my twin brother died, I became a teacher. But in 1907, when military settlements for boys were proposed in Vienna, I led a successful fight against the introduction of militarism into the education system, and was appointed chairman of a new board to organize boys' settlements. And at the end of the war, I established my institution for delinquent boys, and then eventually oversaw the Vienna Municipality Child Guidance System. I left public service in 1932 to run the Psychoanalytic Child Center. Over time, psychoanalysis becomes the key to the maze of my puzzling observations on adolescence, though I always sought a practical therapy of reconciliation.
I finally convinced you to come to a Saturday evening game of Tarok at home.
I managed to slip and break my arm on the way to the party.
Well, you had as much to offer to psychoanalysis as you could hope to gain. You did not need analytic insight to learn how to handle adolescents. You were a master at handling them, individually and in groups, before you had ever even heard of psychoanalysis. Your understanding was intuitive. You weren't only able to reach children otherwise unreachable, you had a secret in you that you were ready to share, if we were only willing to become your students. The secret of how to put others at ease. Yes, I've often used the word intuitive to describe you.
Well, all educational work is an art in which intuition is primary. And this holds true in even greater measure for adolescent re-education, where there is no time to lose. One must just go with a hunch at the first interview.
You invited people to be as open-minded as you. You would scratch your head and say, we can look at this in this way, but we can also look in that way, and there may be other ways too. You were always sweetly, gently challenging us. And whatever you did, it was fun. To you, work and play coincided. A fast ride in a car, a game of Tarot, cracking the clues in a new whodunit, matching wits in that first vital therapeutic interview with a wily scamp. Everything was an enticing adventure.
Let's begin with a simple case in the clinic, rather than something more complicated in the institution. A mother brings her 13-year-old son to the child guidance clinic, complaining about his misbehaviour and insisting that he be sent to a reformatory. The boy disappeared, leaving the key with a neighbour. He did not take money from her purse or her husband, but he had taken money from a kitchen drawer and his sister's savings bank. When he did not come home that night, the mother reported him missing to the police. She met him near their block of flats after another night away. She discussed the home conditions quite frankly with me. Happily married for 15 years, she did home embroidery for a city firm. When I asked if there were any marital disputes, she said, oh yes, little scraps such as everyone has. The relationship between her and the boy seemed to be good. She said, I'm sure he loves me more than his father. My husband is much too easy on him. He lets the boy do almost anything he wants. There had been no quarrel before he ran away. He had no reason to be afraid of punishment. I then interviewed the boy. He made a good first impression. He cast a different light on the relationship between his parents. There was not much harmony between them. When the mother was angry, the father would go away. A week ago, after a quarrel, the father took his fishing tackle and stayed away till late. The man appeared something had happened to him. The boy's attitude to his parents was ambivalent, wavering between affection and rejection. When his mother was too strict, he turned to his father. If his father refused to take him fishing, he complained to his mother. He told his younger sister was not very nice to him, and he often got angry with her. His mother seemed to favour his sister. His sister did better at school than him. He had only one friend, a boy of his own age. He wished to become a mechanic because his parents would not let him go to sea. When did you run away?
On Wednesday.
Where was it exactly?
I'm not sure, but before lunch.
Did you start from home or were you out on the street?
I was at home and left from there.
Was anyone else at home?
No, I was alone.
Where were the others?
Mother was in the laundry, father was at the factory and my sister was at school.
Do you remember if anything was wrong beforehand? Were you frightened or angry?
No.
Perhaps something happened Tuesday evening.
No.
What did you do Tuesday evening?
I went to the store. Mother had given me some money. I brought back some change and she put it in the table drawer.
Now, think a minute. Wasn't your father or your mother angry with you?
No.
Any trouble with your sister?
No. Oh, yes. I was mad at her because she could have her shoes resold before I got new ones.
How's that?
Mother gave her some money and she put it in her savings bank. I don't know. Mother took the money out of the table drawer.
Did you think about running away on Tuesday night?
No.
But when was it then?
Not until Wednesday, and then I left right away.
What did you do beforehand?
I took some soda and soap and the newspaper to Mother in the laundry in our block of flats. Then I went back to our flat.
When you took the things to your mother, was anything wrong?
Mother was cross on account of the stamps.
What stamps?
My friend had had some stamps stolen and they thought I had taken
them.
Everyone, but Mother too.
Were you mad at your mother?
Of course. I thought to myself, she makes me tired.
When you went home from the laundry, what did you do?
I spread a piece of bread with dripping and ate it.
Where were you?
I was looking out the window in the living room. Then I ran away. Well,
not so fast. You were leaning on the windowsill, had finished your bread and dripping. Now think of it and try to remember why all of a sudden you wanted to run away.
I don't know.
Did the idea come to you while you were eating?
After I'd finished, I thought, I'll go to Tool.
Why Tool?
Because I wanted to go to the woods.
Are there woods only in Tulle?
No, but I wanted to get some cherries for my mother.
Well, why just in Tulle?
Because Father owns some cherry trees there. I've often been in Tulle with my father when he went fishing.
I see. You thought you'd go to Tulle to get cherries for your mother. And what then?
There were some cherry stones lying on the windowsill. Then I went into the kitchen and made myself four bread and dripping sandwiches.
What else did you do?
I took some money from the kitchen table drawer and a bag for the cherries.
Where did you get the money?
I took all there was in the drawer.
Where'd you get the rest?
Out of my sister's savings bank.
Where was the bank?
In the chest in the living room.
Was it locked?
Yes, but the key was in Mother's purse.
Where was the purse?
On the table in the living room.
Was there any money in it?
Yes.
How much?
I don't know.
Did you take all the money in your sister's bank, or did you leave some?
I didn't take it all.
Why not?
I didn't need it all for the trip.
Was there money in any other place in the flat?
Yes, in the closet in an old coat of my father's. He kept his money in an old wallet in the pocket.
Was this closet locked?
Yes, but the key was in the lock.
Have you a savings bank too?
Yes.
Well, why didn't you take your own money? You took the money out of your sister's bank. What then?
I put the sandwiches in my pocket and locked the apartment.
Did you take the key with you?
No, I gave it to a neighbour and then I left.
Weren't you afraid you'd meet your mother on the stairs?
No.
What would she have done?
I don't know. I was supposed to put the lunch on to walk.
Did you?
No.
Where did you go when you left home?
To the station.
How did you get there?
I walked. Then I had to wait for 2 hours.
What did you do in the station?
I sat down and ate a sandwich.
When you were in the station, were you afraid that you might get caught?
No, nobody from home ever goes there.
What did you do when you got to Tulle?
Nothing.
Did you stay in the station?
I went straight to the woods.
What did you do in the woods?
I found the cherry trees.
Did you pick any cherries?
No, they weren't ripe. And then I was afraid to go home.
Well, what did you do then?
I walked around the woods hunting strawberries. And there were other cherry trees there. I took some cherries and ate them.
Did you take some from these trees for your mother?
No.
How long did you stay in the woods?
Until it was quite dark. Then it started to rain.
Where did you go that night?
I slept in a barn.
He now described in more detail how he slept the night and was careful. He had to avoid being discovered by the farmer. How lonely he was all by himself in the hay. How he left the barn as soon as it was light. It rained all day, but he remained in the woods. He didn't think much about home. At night, he crept back into the barn. He ate the next, now stale, sandwich. The last one. The next morning. And so it was hunger that drove him home. Another short talk with the mother confirmed the boy's story. After hearing the reasons the boy gave, she was inclined to view the stealing and the running away less seriously. But she could not understand why he had not told this to her himself. End of story. But is the matter as simple as the mother thought? There were two distinct phases in his behaviour. The boy himself told us where the one ended and the other began. The cherries weren't ripe, and then I was afraid to go home. One thing is certain. The boy explains his action by his wish to get cherries for his mother. Well, we don't yet know whether he told the truth. Did he lie? It's possible. He had refused to give his mother any explanation, and he knew she had brought him to me to be sent to a reformatory. His fate depended on the impression he made on me. His mother's attitude changed once she learned from me that a loving thought had prompted his running away. Does the rest of his conduct make us feel that this was the case? Yes, because he said at first that he wanted to go to Tulle to get the wood, and only later mentioned the cherry trees. The boy's telling me that he stole some cherries from trees which did not belong to his father, reveals honesty. At this, the fact that he took with him a bag for the cherries, that he took no money that he needed, the fellow fare, nothing else. That he spent nothing on himself and saved the remainder for the return trip. That he was frightened when he discovered that he could not carry out his plan because the cherries were not ripe. It seems impossible that he was lying. And yet, the assumption that he was telling the truth is equally unsatisfactory, because there seems to be no reason why he should have thought affectionately of his mother at that time.
You, Mr. Eichhorn, were never the person to build up a big theory. You're the one who feels his way down a path, hoping for the best, but always thinking about the trouble ahead, and not with any grand view of it all.
Maybe the cherries were an act of conciliation. But that assumption is refuted by another fact he stole. And anyway, why come back empty-handed? Why not fill the bag with stolen cherries for his mother? Perhaps his sweet tooth was the cause, even though he was unaware of it. He'd eaten his bread, he wanted something more. He saw some cherry stones on the windowsill. He conceived the idea of getting some cherries for his mother, but his own desire for cherries disguised itself in this form. His theft would be socially acceptable because he spent none of the money on himself. He would naturally get some of the cherries. But he had his appetite been strong enough to make him steal, he would hardly have suffered the delayed satisfaction occasioned by the long wait in the station and the ride to Tung. He would have bought himself something to eat. It would have been easy for him to take more money to satisfy his desires.
At the same time as our educational working group was responding to the development of your manuscript of Wayward Youth, Mr. Eichhorn, a group of young University of Vienna medical students had come into the orbit of the Vienna Psychoanalytical Society, working primarily in the free outpatients clinic and enrolling in our psychoanalytic training institute as it began to establish itself. Among them, Wilhelm Reich. They had themselves already formed a seminar on sexuality, and they also brought their energy and socialist concerns for Vienna's working classes to us.
Now, Reich's rise to prominence was meteoric.
He was nearly 2 years younger than me. Papa was smitten. Reich began practicing as an analyst while still a student and was the youngest instructor at the training institute, where his classes on technique and character analysis were crucial to all of us.
The Kinder Seminar, your papa and the other elders used to call you. As the training institute became more formally established, you Kinder did most of the training analyses. You, Miss Freud, taught the child analysis seminar, and I taught the seminar on delinquency. But we continued our weekly educational group, which we opened up to social workers and teachers, and we established a journal. We developed training programs for educators and school administrators.
I had the task of teaching the history of psychoanalysis at the training institute, and in doing so had to try to integrate Papa's changing views. I had grown up with the working concepts of the division of the mind into unconscious, preconscious, and conscious. I felt on familiar ground there, and I experienced some hesitations and difficulties when Papa introduced the new division into id, ego, and superego, and even more with the death drive. My argument was at the time that the gain accomplished by recognition of the unconscious parts of the ego did not make up for the loss of the essential distinctions between consciousness and unconsciousness. Even when I tried very hard to use the new structural terms, I felt half-hearted and visualized matters for myself always by means of the older terms. But as I prepared my lectures, I always took them to Papa for consultation and approval. I wanted to see a simplicity. Others saw things in coldly theoretical terms, though of course not you, Mr. Eichhorn. My way and your way were totally practical. Papa thought the bigger picture would come to me with more experience, and my discussions with you helped me with this, and also with my responses to Mrs. Klein's child analytic theory and technique. You, Mr. Eichhorn, were reassuringly adamant right from the start that Mrs. Klein was mistaken in her equation of delinquency and neurosis, and you helped me define the differences between her and my approaches for my first book, Introduction to the Technique of Child Analysis.
The Klein camp maintained that you, as they saw it, so under the influence of your papa, and therefore to them in the throes of an unresolved Oedipus complex, were projecting that personal state of affairs into your technique of child analysis, and that your papa could not be objective in this matter. But your papa could do little about the controversy because he felt that he had no way to defend himself against the charge of nepotism. There was also the debate over the practice of psychoanalysis by non-medical people like you and I. Your papa could tolerate the dispute, citing it as evidence that differences of opinion were allowed after all. But it enraged him that others might disagree with his right to appoint you, his youngest daughter, an analyst. And he viewed opposition to lay analysis as a personal attack on you.
When I was elected General Secretary for the International Association, I was the one on the executive board who both stood for lay analysis and was a lay analyst. I was also the one who represented Papa and Papa's views.
Mrs. Klein suggests that from the start of the analytic sessions, deep interpretations of the child's play should be offered by the analyst to the child. But although children do quickly form transference reactions with the adolescent, it does not recapitulate parental relations. The child is not ready to reproduce a new edition of his love relationship because his original objects, the parents, are still real and present as love objects. Therapists must also seek to develop an understanding of the parental superego in relation to the superego structure of the child and the importance of the parental superego potential for empathy with the therapist so that the parents are eased into giving way to the therapeutic ends.
If only we had known what battles lay ahead. My courses for nursery and primary school teachers and yours for secondary school teachers spread psychoanalytic views of child development into the Viennese municipal school system, and your series of lectures for the Viennese Board of Education provided a forum for school matters.
Well, the information was presented to them. Whether they really wanted it was another matter. But over time, our child analytic practice in Vienna changed. We spent less time on preparation with child and parent. We just plunged in. We worry less about pedagogic functions during the analysis, since a successful analysis in any case would produce better learning. We saw children as young as 2, began to treat even into late adolescence. We worked increasingly on the analysis of defences or resistances, incorporating elements of Wilhelm Reich's character analysis techniques. The order in which the young child has developed defences is seen in the order in which the child recapitulates the early defences in adolescence, working down through the defences to the secret of the defence structure. Now, let us go back to our boy. He's persisted on berries and 3 sandwiches for 3 days. He spent no money on food. He did not steal any money elsewhere. Now, there are cases where stealing is the result of uninhibited appetite, but this does not seem to be one of them. We can hardly say that the boy lied, but we cannot maintain that he told the truth. Is this possible? And now I raise the question I have purposefully overlooked. Why the boy spent the money taken from his sister's bank and that from the kitchen drawer and none of his own, or his mother's, or his father's, although it was equally accessible. Nor can the boy's affection for his mother or sweet tooth be accepted as the cause. So, where shall we find the motive?
You believed unswervingly that new role models and positive group interaction may induce psychic restructuring in adolescence. A strong, socially directed superego depended on good parenting. Orphans, the illegitimate and the wayward, could not achieve this at home. Therefore you, Mr. Eichhorn, used the transference towards the adult workers of the institution to induce a corrective experience in delinquent adolescents.
One type of adolescent is the pseudo-independent who superficially agrees to treatment but is actually vigorously resistant. Now, he must be made to feel uncomfortable. For example, one boy who imagined that if he were only given his freedom, all his problems would vanish. I saw the case of a boy who had gambled on the stock exchange and made a lot of money. At 14, he began to work as a cashier for a street money changer, and this made it possible for him to speculate on his own. This rascal accumulated a small fortune and imported goods which he sold as a bootlegger. Then when his speculation went awry, he began pawning his mother's clothes and jewellery. So this widow brought him to the attention of social services, and then he came into our care. He was one of those boys who give no apparent trouble in the institution. inwardly demoralized, outwardly smooth as glass. The mask offers no point of attack. Our man of the world knew how to withdraw in the nicest possible way from every effort to influence him. I thought it would be a good idea to get him away from the security of the institution so he could compare it with the discomforts of destitution in the real world. So he was subtly encouraged and helped to run away. And when the child was returned to us, without reproach, distraught and starving, he was then ready to form a dependent transference to the institution and its staff. How strongly positive the transference was, I only learned from a mistake I made a bit later. This boy was given the job of bringing the supplies from the city to the institution and accounting for his stores. But one day, I gave him grounds for extreme jealousy by asking one of his comrades to check his bookkeeping. I only succeeded in making good his distress with great difficulty and the unswerving assistance of his counselor. We induced idealization towards those offering treatment by encouraging all the workers to have the skills and talents associated with delinquency. For example, the ability to effectively plan criminal acts. The workers must identify with the delinquent youngsters and their motivations. Whoever wants to work successfully in this field must step out of his own secure social position and be receptive to the intricacies of the delinquent's character. You have to understand how wayward youth himself experiences society. He more often than not experiences and fights a single-handed battle as a rebel who resents all demands for conformity as an unnatural deprivation of his essential freedom. So he must be disconcerted in seeing that you, if you chose to, would be even more successful at the same crime.
What a wonderful criminal mastermind you would have made, Mr. Eichhorn.
It's never too late to taste the sweets of criminality, Miss Freud.
Only if I could be part of your gang, Mr. Eichhorn. But many felt you underplayed your own extraordinary empathy with the wayward, and they were sceptical of your claim that any teacher in any classroom could successfully practice this art of re-education, and they questioned the intense identification of the youngsters with the institution.
Well, at the institution, which were going to be the most damaged. Most youngsters stayed at home and were managed through child guidance. Of course, our theoretical and technical views had a social and political as well as psychoanalytic interest, especially in Red Vienna. Most of the members of the Kinder Seminar were anyway of socialist orientation. So evidence that altering environment improved psychic conditions in children was crucial to their worldview. But education is no more than a means for unfolding existing potentials. It cannot add anything new to the individual. The educator can only modify the environmental circumstances to present the most advantageous conditions for development. You, Miss Freud, were not a socialist. Oh dear, no. No more than I. And you had not the kind of experiences in the radical youth movement characteristic of the Kinder Seminar. But you were always sympathetic to the wayward and the deprived, as your experimental nursery showed. And you also supported the experimental school for children in analysis, both financed by Mrs. Burlingham.
The school proved to be a mistake. Lurching from compulsion, too protective, to liberation from compulsion, too permissive, resulting in chaos. But the nursery was incisive. Our desire in the nursery was to gather direct information, especially about the second year of life, through observation. A thorough objective knowledge of infancy was our goal, as desired by Papa. The remarkable thing about Papa, unlike all the others, was that he continually emphasised how much remained unexplained and uncertain. One got the feeling with him of being surrounded by the completely questionable, the unknown, where still only here and there one can glimpse the first clues. With the other psychoanalytic writers, everything is always known and fixed, tidied up. Papa's views just kept on changing. His new theory of anxiety, for example, which situated anxiety in the ego. Anxiety now dictated repression in response to danger rather than arising as a consequence of repression. Imagine the confusion for Kinder like Reich, who had recently constructed theories based on speculation about the old dogma, now itself speculatively discarded by Papa. Papa never wrote down an idea now that he had not tried out on me.
You were his hope for the future as well as his nurse. You always had to worry about your father, as his views changed, as the issues of the succession soured, as his theories about anti-Semitism and the origins of Judaism spun out, as he went from one episode of trouble, heart, lungs, sinuses, bowels, to another, and from one jaw operation to another.
Papa was very calm and in a good frame of mind and not afraid, and I always tried to catch some of this from him. It is good that I always reacted so slowly, for that way I could function when it was needed most. Somewhere each operation on Papa took a bit of me. But that is just the way it is. One cannot ask for the currants without the surrounding bun.
Man, you were annoyed at being the subject of gossip again, either on your own, through the criticisms of the Kleinians, and relation to your ailing Papa as well, or as Mrs. Burlingham's companion. You disliked it when we remarked on your so evident new contentment, and you completely squashed any suggestion that your American friend, let alone her wealth, had made a difference.
Like me, Mrs. Burlingham had been the youngest child, and always felt herself the unwanted one. She herself began seeing patients while in training with Papa.
Indeed, remember, my son Walter was one of her first patients.
She renovated the apartment above ours to a most delightful standard of comfort, and I too moved in. All the while I was analysing her four children. Mrs. Burlingham and I shared, and we still share, in London, the most agreeable and unalloyed companionship, continuing our nursery work, now resettling parentless children who survived the camps. Oh, and we have a country cottage again. You know, despite all the upheavals of illness and exile, Mrs. Burlingham remained in analysis with Papa right up until his death.
I was always particularly taken by the honesty of her portrayals of the reactions of parents, particularly mothers, to their children's adolescence.
In the new introductory lectures, Papa called her his trustworthy witness. And for you, Mr. Eichhorn, reading her testimony, a double perspective, as both an analyst and as parent of her patient.
And as social carer as well. And for you, Miss Freud, judging your roles as analyst, re-educator, and indeed parent of the Burlingham children.
I continue to offer analysis to her now adult children, circumstances and need permitting. Is it not so very worthwhile to strive to become completely all right?
Well, it was always hard for you to balance your roles and duties, both public and private. But the municipal government of Vienna's offer to the Psychoanalytic Society of a parcel of land for our headquarters was heartening, remarkably legitimizing for us after all the earlier struggles.
But for most of the socialist-leaning Jewish psychoanalysts in Vienna, the later suppression of the Social Democrats and the installation of the one-party corporate state marked the end of their Viennese dream.
Though youth service and education arrangements remained more or less in place.
The Berlin Jewish analysts began to flee in 1933, some at first back to Vienna. By 1934, German psychoanalysis was an Aryan business.
Most of us at first believed that placating the Nazis would save psychoanalysis.
That's why the Jewish members in Germany withdrew from the Institute and elected two Aryan analysts as the sole members of the executive committee. And quite apart from Wilhelm Reich's destructiveness, following his extreme reaction to what he saw as Papa's rejection of him, which we could only deal with by exclusion, there were a few other mavericks who threatened the whole future of German analysis by reckless politicking. It was such a tightrope that we constantly walked now. Psychoanalysis had been denounced as Jewish science, and the few remaining Aryan analysts in Germany were co-opted into the new official Reich Psychotherapeutic Institute.
The Göring Institute, led by Matthias Heinrich Göring, a cousin of Hermann, an institute for the science of German soul healing. Meanwhile, you, Miss Freud, now leader of the Vienna Society, worked tirelessly on finding refugee placements.
One lived just in the present and had to get used to it. Even though we only expected the Austrian situation to get worse and worse, most of the younger members wanted to keep active the society, the day centre and the child guidance network. But the radicals, like Reich, just had to be rooted out.
You were the one who continued to talk to Reich, and you were the first to recognise just how crazy he was.
After he went to Berlin and his wife Annie came into analysis with me, and I started to advise her on the re-education of her daughters, he truly and openly hated me.
And you had no time for any of the other bold, radical dogmatists.
They simply couldn't keep up with Papa's open-mindedness. There are an extraordinary large number of methods used by our ego in the discharge of its defensive functions. In my book, The Ego and the Mechanisms of Defense, I sought to review all the defense mechanisms that have been isolated and described in the history of psychoanalysis. Aggressive urges may become redirected from the child's main love objects, the parents, to people of lesser importance in the child's life. This relieves the intimate family relationships of their negativity, but the gain is offset by the emergence of an excessively negative and hostile attitude towards people outside the family circle.
Strangers, casual acquaintances, servants, foreigners.
And other races. Attitudes such as these are not reversible by experience, since they are not rooted in a real assessment of the hated, but arise from the necessity to prevent the hate reactions from reverting to the original, ambivalently loved one.
Well, then there is also the identification with the aggressor, which I had highlighted in Wayward Youth.
Oh, and the issue of altruism, Mr. Eichel.
Indeed, Miss Freud. Like Mrs. Burlingham, you were frank in the lightly disguised presentation of your own circumstances. The young woman who had put away the trappings of adornment to pursue her chosen path.
I presented a first edition of The Ego and the Mechanisms of Defense to Papa on his 80th birthday, May 6, 1936. And later, in 1939, Papa gave me, inscribed, a first copy of Moses and Monotheism. This was the first time that he had ever given me one of his books as a gift, and it remains among my most precious possessions.
Among the precepts of the Mosaic religion, there is one that's of greater importance than appears at the beginning. This is the prohibition against making an image of God, the compulsion to worship a God whom one cannot see. If this prohibition were accepted, it must have a profound effect, for it meant that a sensory perception was given second place to what may be called an abstract idea. Triumph of intellectuality over sensuality, or strictly speaking, an instinctual renunciation with all its necessary psychological consequences. Moses conveyed to the Jews an exalted sense of being a chosen people. The dematerialization of God brought a fresh and valuable contribution to their secret treasure. The gift of inwardness is a gift of Judaism.
I attended a consultation of the directorship of the Vienna Institute on March 20th, 1938, only 2 days after the Anschluss, where it was announced that the Institute would become an adjunct of the Goering Institute with the simultaneous exclusion of all non-Aryan members. Many non-Jewish members resigned in protest, and many also sought to join their Jewish colleagues in exile, though not you, Mr. Eichel. On March 28, 1938, we received good news. The British government would permit us and other Viennese psychoanalysts to emigrate to England. And after my arrest and interrogation by the Gestapo, it was a matter of simply getting out. We had our passports, but not a statement of no impediment, which would indicate that all our debts and taxes had been paid. Papa received a statement about the value of antiquities that he would have to pay tax on to take them out of the country. The Nazis also claimed that we owed a debt to our publishing company, which was now in their hands. We were in the same position as many Jews. They took all we had and then demanded we pay taxes on it. They had seized the press and all our Austrian savings, so we were in an impossible situation. You must pay taxes and all your debts, but we have confiscated all your financial resources. Wonderful Marie Bonaparte, Princess of Greece, stepped in and paid our debts to the Nazis. So we were free to go.
The Austrian Psychoanalytic Society was officially dissolved on August 25th, 1938. There was officially now only a study group and a training group affiliated to the Goering Institute. My son Thomas, a member of the Fatherland Front, had been detained in Dachau for anti-German activity, and my wife was unwell. So I stayed on, alone. The Goering Institute, from its headquarters in Berlin, strongly supported educational counseling in Vienna, continuing and expanding the existing structure of the municipal program of kindergartens and day nurseries, and a new juvenile justice assistance program with additional psychologists and youth workers. I was called to lecture in Berlin in 1938 and again in 1941. I attended Matthias Goering's 60th birthday celebrations in Berlin in 1939. In 1939, as a lay therapist, I was required to apply to register as a lay health practitioner. Though I did not believe my duties placed me under such an obligation to so register, since as a member of the Goering Institute, I practiced in close collaboration with physicians anyway, and it was well documented that we lay anesthetists had always done so. But from now on, my work was officially always supervised by physicians. In early 1944, I was made extraordinary member of the newly reorganized Goering Institute, and I was acting director of Viennese operations in the absence of the director on medical army duties. And then, in mid-44, the bombing started. And through all these years, I quietly proceeded to undertake a number of training analyses, both officially and unofficially in my home, just south of Vienna, and to supervise the psychoanalytic study group, and waited. I did it all for your papa. You know, I passed by your apartment every opportunity, but always, always lingered there on the anniversary of your departure. Matthias Heinrich Goering would not have risen to his prominence as Reich Director of Psychotherapy if he had not been the cousin of Hermann. Matthias had founded an educational counseling service in Germany in 1928, and his ideas and structures had much in common with my ways of working. We came to respect each other's work. Goering was more like an Adlerian. And in Red Vienna, the Adlerians had also been very successful in educational counseling and community schooling. And indeed, the socialist ideals of community orientation of many of the Kinder Seminar led at times to the charge of becoming Adlerian. Even you, Miss Freud, worried at times about being labelled a wild Adler.
Adler stressed the importance of the patient's synthesizing abilities. What the psyche does to the drive, rather than what the drives do to the psyche. Adler always insisted on the patient's wholeness being the key to the symptoms, and would attach no value to symptoms apart from the individual personality. The individual represented the unified whole to which all parts cooperate towards a common goal.
Well, Adler aimed to lead patients out of their preoccupied isolation into communitarianism, whereas the papa conceived of the individual accomplishing great things in solitude.
And considered culture the result of frustration of drives.
We who are analysts set before us as our aim the most complete and profoundest possible analysis of whoever may be our patient. We do not seek to bring him relief by receiving him into the community. We seek rather to enrich him from his own internal resources, by putting at the disposal of his ego those energies which, owing to repression, are inaccessibly confined to his unconscious, as well as those which his ego is obliged to squander in the fruitless task of maintaining these repressions. We cannot guide patients in their synthesis. We can, by analytic work, only prepare them for it. In 1933, Matthias Heinrich Goering had published a book on the relationship between Adlerian individual psychology and religion. To love means to be able to merge into the other, to understand one's fellow man, the desire overwhelmingly to help him. Nazi psychotherapy, soul healing, it aimed at affecting the super race. It certainly was valued for helping to lift the morale and productivity of workers, soldiers, and airmen. It aimed to cure, or apparently cure, sexual and intoxicant disorders, and we did save some from incarceration, and no doubt of deep destruction. Therapists counseled the Nazi youth and maternal organizations. But we all had subscribed to a good dose of Nazi nonsense. We drifted along with that tide. We drifted along with that tide. Quick cures, or incarceration, or flee with the order of the day. And some left the fleeing too late and perished. Let me tell you only one tale, Miss Freud. You remember Karl, Baron von Montechitsky?
Of course. I'm acquainted with his sister and mother in London. Her mother was an early patient of Papa's. Karl had more money than sense, always trying to buy the affection of his latest idealized one. He gave Wilhelm Reich a lot of financial assistance with Sexpol and wrote terribly embarrassing articles about the coming sexual revolution. Did not Karl die in a camp?
Well, Karl followed Wilhelm Reich to Berlin and then into Scandinavian exile. But as Reich moved further into his crazy vegetative therapy, Karl became disillusioned and he returned to Vienna, where he recommenced his studies of medicine. Yes, most of his family fled, but Karl remained after the Anschluss and was able, with excellent legal advice and a great deal of capital, to reclaim the family estate. He undertook a further private training analysis with me, and in June 1940, I applied to Berlin for permission for Karl to be admitted to the teaching faculty of the Berlin and Vienna Branch Institute. But the answer was unequivocal. For persons of first degree mixed race, there is hardly a possibility to win approbation. It was a no-win situation for someone like Karl. His money could buy him favors like the return of the family estate. The malicious tongues wagged. Had Karl paid to have manufactured the documentary evidence that he had a Jewish grandmother just in order to avoid active military service? In winter 1940, Karl volunteered to serve in the German army, hoping to escape the discrimination and rumors. He was dismissed as unworthy for military action, even as a reservist. Then apparently, the rejected Karl formed a tiny resistance group, listening to BBC, printing leaflets, radical talk, especially dangerous for one of mixed race and a former Reichian and also a communist. He was very, very naive and quite reckless and was eventually arrested in late 1942 for harboring Jews and helping them escape. He was held at Gestapo headquarters in Vienna for a long time. And then I understand, yes, he died in a camp.
The number of our members dropped by 64 during the war. We had left Papa's sisters behind in Vienna, financially sound and safe and cozy in apartments that they owned. Four harmless little old ladies.
I would have liked to resume my own work with adolescents in the devastation of post-war Vienna, just as I had done after the First War. but recruiting and training young analysts is now the chief priority in our elegant American-sponsored new premises. Analysts give talks to civic associations to raise morale, and although the Americans seem to welcome such efforts, there is little public response. Our Vienna is a terribly depressed, ruined city. Maya Vini's apartment was bombed out, you know.
How strange it is to carry a past within one that can no longer be built upon.
Really, few in Vienna have much time for psychoanalytic inwardness now. Forgetting, repressing, denying. How to come out of the horrors, this fixed, charming smile. Oh, and there have been plenty of malicious mutterings that I had been protected by Goering, but that my international status... At one time, wayward youth was better known in the United States than the interpretation of dreams. And my connections with the Red Cross that helped to legitimize Goering's activities.
Others might say that your skill with delinquents and identification with the adolescent criminal mind gave you a particular insight into how to deal with the Nazis. A variation on the old double allegiance and the mechanisms of defense, and just good old unheroic survival. Papa said, you can hold on to your convictions, even if they have to be abandoned on the outside. We Jewish people had had the misfortune, or fortune, of accumulating a host of experiences of this kind through our history. But when you give in on the outside, you may eventually give in on the inside too.
Holding on.
It all depends what you hold on to inside.
Wayward youth was in circulation through the Goering years, but with your papa's preface excised. You know, I refused to participate in the liquidation of the psychoanalytic press and its assets, and I arranged for that photographic record of your apartment.
A blessed record.
And I organized that final tarot party for your papa. And then I stayed on alone, training others for future, better times.
And here we are, reunited, Mr. Eichhorn, Easter 1948, in Lausanne. I think you really do spoil me too much here in Lausanne. It is quite true, in England I have got out of the habit of expecting people to care for me, or, more accurately, to worry about me. There we fight, we compromise, we fight, we go our own ways. I don't expend my time and energy hopelessly trying to counteract Mrs. Klein's influence. And there is something else. I never speak about my father the way I did now with you. I never do it because I really cannot. It comes from too deeply within and forces too much to the surface. But it is very beautiful to do it with you. He has been dead now for 8.5 years. But when I let myself go, then it always seems as if his death has been only yesterday. That's probably also the reason I never let myself go. We assume that the process of mourning for a loved one will last while the emotions of the mourner are concentrated on the loss, as well as on the necessity of withdrawing feeling from the inner image of the dead. So far as this means withdrawing from the external world, the task of mourning interferes with life itself. So far as it signifies reunion with the dead by means of reviving and reliving the memories concerning him, mourning is as absorbing and fulfilling as it is painful. But in dreams, the identification with the lost one is derived from a specific infantile experience when the dreamer, as a child, felt unloved, rejected and neglected.
May we use do in our letters, even if not in public, so that I may freely write my heart and mine. That you tell me so much about your father comes as no surprise. He is my father too. You alone know the depths of my love for him. I don't know if you have realized that since you left Vienna and I stayed on alone, all my activities were dedicated to him. I don't know how great the significance of these activities is, but I do know that they are my single task. When I congratulated him on his 80th birthday and presented him with a copy of my Techniques of Educational Guidance, he wrote in reply, I credit you also to my successes. Here he gave me acknowledgement that I am his creation, his son.
In the end, we depend on the creatures that we made.
You may hold it against me that I am proud of it, or think that I feel too deeply that I belong to him. But his death doesn't change that at all. You say that I spoil you too much. That is nothing to the way I would like to care for you. I am angered that your social environment in England offers no compassion, and I really am worried about you. The coughing, your exhaustion, your illnesses, and your self-abnegation make me worry.
May I call you Icon, and you may call me Anna, but I would not like to use do with you because I know from experience that I simply could not get used to it. It would have the reverse effect and not bring me closer to you. So, if it suits you, we will make it Icon and Anna, both when we meet alone and in company.
Now I spend so much time in my daydreams with you, Anna, and there I can love and care for you.
Promise me that you will always remain the same, and that you will remain my friend. And I do not want to be reminded that you are older than me.
Like you, Anna, I never liked my first name, because no one ever used it in an abbreviated form. My twin was always called by a nickname, something I always passionately wished would happen to me. Because of this, I felt I wasn't loved enough.
And the boy in the case study?
Ah, we must discover the psychic drive behind the behaviour. So let's try another approach. We found the boy's anger with his mother culminated in the wish to punish her. If revenge conquered scruple, he would have stolen and run away. If moral training triumphed, there would be no delinquency. If neither conquered, we have a situation favourable for producing a symptom. A symptom could be formed out of a revengeful and a moral purpose, provided that both could find partial satisfaction in a single act. And the boy's journey to Tulln represents such a solution. We can imagine that the conflict that took place when he stood by the window eating his bread and dripping came to an end when he saw the cherry stones on the windowsill and resolved to go to Tulln. We know he wanted revenge. He can imitate his father and choose his father's method of causing his mother worry and stress by going missing. The moral purpose, to do something nice for his mother, is not capable of thwarting the gratification of revenge, but it serves to change the conscious form of the revenge by adding a motive of kindness. The idea of bringing cherries as a gift is united with the other purpose of going missing. So, the symptom is complete.
Conflict solution.
Solution.
Via compromise. Icon's death on October 13th, 1949 was a kind of full stop at the end of a great chapter in analysis and in all our lives. The re-educator's double allegiance and identification with society on the one hand and the world of the delinquent on the other remain for him a fascinating problem. Early in his own analysis, he realised that he owed his interest in delinquency and probably his own therapeutic success with the wayward to an unstable phase in his own adolescence, when he had narrowly missed becoming a delinquent himself. His crisis had been that he had felt less talented and less favoured than his twin brother, who had died. Less talented and less favoured. I do know that feeling. What I had always wanted for myself, from the beginning, is probably nothing more than the affection of the people with whom I am in contact, and their good opinion of me. With Icon, my shy goy, I had that.